Welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I am Alex Kochman, Director of Long-Term Missionary Mobilization for ABWE, joined by Scott Dunford, Vice President of Mobilization and Communications here. And we are joined through the power of the World Wide Web by a very special guest, and we are praying that the technology holds up. But Scott, would you introduce our guest for us, please?
You know, I've done so much speaking on missions. I know Dr. Sills has done twice as much, and every single time you know there will be some technological problem, and so I don't know, it just must be the missionary thing going on right now, because we've had no end of the technological issues.
I think the enemy doesn't want this to happen.
So we're going to keep pushing through. But Dr. Sills is a professor of missiology and cultural anthropology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But before that, he and his wife Mary served as missionaries in Ecuador to the Quechua people, and started a seminary and president at the Ecuadorian Baptist Theological Seminary there in Ecuador. And so we're thrilled to have him on our show. We give out his books regularly to our missionaries, The Missionary Call. He's got a book called Reaching and Teaching, and then another book called Hearts, Hands, and Heads. And excited to have you join our show today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
I was talking with a young lady that came to our church raising her support as a missionary yesterday, and she said that your book, The Missionary Call, was super helpful for her to discern her calling into cross-cultural ministry. But really what we wanted to start is by addressing your calling to missions. And we'd love to hear a little bit about you, the work that you're doing now with Reaching and Teaching, as well as with the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But also, how did God call you, and how have you played that out over the course of your career?
Okay. I'll try to keep it short because I could go on all day about this, as you can imagine. But I grew up in a Southern Baptist home. My mom was organist. My dad was deacon, Sunday school teacher, and all that. But my aunt and uncle, they were career missionaries in Indonesia with the Southern Baptists. I just grew up knowing that's what really committed Christian kind of people did. When I was a young kid, I did what good boys were supposed to do. I walked the aisle, I got baptized, and did all those kinds of things. But I wasn't a believer. I was just sort of going through the motions, and I didn't realize that at the time. And then as an adult, a young adult, I was very much living out in the world. By God's grace, I met my wife. We were married for 5 years when the Lord saved us. When the Lord saved us, it was such a radical 180, complete change. Just so the Lord saved me when I was 25, saved Mary a couple of months after that, and we began our spiritual pilgrimage, which included awareness of missions, and we had a brand new baby boy, and my wife, her background had been moving around all over the place. Her father was a career fighter pilot in the Air Force, and so she didn't have a home growing up where she could always consider that her home base, and so she wanted that, and it was just a hard decision for her. But we began to go on short-term mission trips, and the short-term mission trips we went on in the summers, little by little, God began to use to stir our hearts that maybe this is what he had for us. I began to feel more and more passionate about it, and about the time that all this is going on, I started my undergraduate work at a Presbyterian college in our town, and was doing an undergraduate degree in biblical studies in preparation for ministry of some kind. And some of the books that I read were the Elizabeth Elliot books of Shadow of the Almighty, Through Gates of Splendor, and Jungle Pilot about Nate Saint. And those kinds of books really stirred me in a profound way. And it was in 1989. I had been on a short-term mission trip to Ecuador over on the coast a couple of years before. But in 89, as I stood out at Nate Saint's house, looking back up the Pastaza River Valley towards sunset, and it was almost a palpable sense. It sounds, I'm the least mystical person you'd ever want to meet, but God just really stirred my heart, and that I thought, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. So we came back from that trip, and at that time, I was doing okay in business. I was a broker in property management and was very involved in my local church, but while I was having a lot of excuses about why I should not sell it all and go, I knew after that trip, that was it. So we came back, sold our house, sold everything we had, moved to a seminary because we went with the Southern Baptists. And the requirement at that time is that you had a Master of Divinity and 2 years of ministry experience, which by then I had. But we sold everything. We moved and served with the Highland Quechua people. And of course, Ecuador is a small country. It's only the size of, say, Colorado, and you have coastal area with banana country and all that. You have the high Andes mountains, and you have the jungle. And so you work in all kinds of different contexts. And that is what we were doing when I came back to do my doctoral work. And then they asked me to run the seminary, which I did. And then Southern Seminary contacted me and asked me if I would come and teach missions here. So I came here in 2000, continued to travel around the world, training pastors, go back and forth to Ecuador a good deal. I have a son, a daughter-in-law, and five grandchildren there in Ecuador with Reaching and Teaching. Also, all of our adult life, we've been involved in missions, first in Ecuador and then through Southern Seminary, teaching missions and cultural anthropology here, starting Reaching and Teaching. Our son, daughter-in-law, and five of our grandkids are missionaries in Ecuador with Reaching and Teaching. And it's just, that's who I am. That's how I think. That's what I write about, talk about, try to counsel people about. And that's what I hope I spend the rest of my days doing.
So, Dr. Sills, you know, you've got a lot of education in the area of missions. You've got two doctorates. You're teaching at one of the largest seminaries in the world on missions. You're the president of a mission agency. You've taught overseas on missions. You're very aware of all the discussions that are going on in the area of missions right now. And certainly there's a huge emphasis in the last, you know, 30, 40 years on the area of unreached people groups. And yet you're kind of drawing attention in some ways to places that a lot of missiologists are saying, you know, calling quote unquote reached, and focusing a lot on places like South America. So my question for you is, why are you focusing again on those areas like South America that other people are calling reached? Why do you think that we need to still engage in those parts of the world that some agencies are just moving totally away from?
Well, I think the great error of our time is that we have embraced, I don't want to say lie, because that sort of brings in a connotation of, I think people are intentionally misleading. I don't think it was intentional, but the error of our age is that we have embraced the idea that the Great Commission equals reaching the unreached. Well, I mean, certainly we need to reach the unreached. So, you know, every tribe needs to hear the gospel, and you must hear the gospel to be saved. And Jesus has told us to go. But what did he say do? He said, go and make disciples of all nations, not go and get a show of hands in all nations. He didn't say, go ye therefore and get decisions from all men. He said, go and make disciples. And then he even said, teaching them to obey all that I have commanded. And so if we're going to teach all that he has commanded, that means it requires time. It's hard work. It's not as exciting. It doesn't show as many numbers as just blasting in and doing an evangelistic crusade and getting a show of hands and leave. In fact, a lot of the people, the more we learn about different cultures, which is kind of my area at Southern, the more we learn about cultures, the more we realize that many of the people who raise their hands didn't even understand what it is they were agreeing to. You know, if they believe that all humans came from the union of two different kinds of jungle birds, and the missionary came and said John 3:16, and they think, wow, yeah, and they're just so excited about that because the missionary's always also bringing medicine or aluminum pots, or he's their contact with the outside world, and they're just so glad to have him as their friend, so they'll do anything he says. But when he leaves, they're asking themselves, now, which one of those jungle birds loved us so much that he gave his only son? And they try to interpret his message against their old background. They take the little they know about Christianity, they blend it with their entire worldview of everything that they believe through the years, and we realize that teaching them to obey everything that Christ commanded means we stay, we learn the language, we learn the worldview, we learn the rhythm of life, the gatekeepers, how they make decisions, and help them understand God's word, how it applies to their lives, and more importantly, 2 Timothy 2:2, how they can teach those who come behind them. And we've just not done that, so that you, when you look over our shoulder, where all we've been around the world as missionaries, you realize this need for speed pushed us on before the people were able to do what Jesus sent us to teach them to do. Now, the argument has been made by some that, well, look, they've got a Bible, they've got the Holy Spirit, he'll lead them into all truth. But in fact, that's, number one, that's terrible hermeneutics. But number two, they don't have the Bible. Out of the 7,000 languages, or 6,913
languages in the world today, we still, after 2,000 years of the Great Commission, we only have a little less than 450 Bibles, about 1,200 New Testaments.
Yeah.
But thousands of languages don't have a single word in their language yet. And even if they did, it's like the Ethiopian eunuch. You know, Philip said, "You understand what you're reading?" And he said, "How can I unless someone explains it to me?"
Mm. I just had a dramatic, you know, visual of this. We went down to the Museum of the Bible, which is just an hour and a half from
here. Oh, I know what you're, talking about, because my parents were just there and they sent me a photo of exactly what you're going to say.
There you go. I don't need to tell a story.
We're on the same wavelength.
You walk into the room, and this room where all the translations of the Bible are, and you and the yellow is the translations that are not done, and most of the room is yellow, and it is a striking, dramatic, visual of how much work there is still to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if they had the Bible, some of the places we go there, and just a few months ago, I preached in one of these very kinds of places where the pastor of that church also pastors 11 other churches, and he's never had one day of preparation, theological training, anything at all. And guys like that, we'll have a class of say 30 or 40 guys in our reaching and teaching classes, and they're asking questions. Now they're pastoring 2, 3, 4, 5 churches, whatever, and they'll ask, "So now, when was Jesus saved? Was that before or after the resurrection?"
Yeah.
Or what was the name of that lady that saved and baptized Jesus? And these are places, these are like people who've had the Bible for years, for generations, right, and yet they still don't understand what the Bible says. In fact, what we know is 70 to 80% of the world is not highly literate like we are. If you can take a book you've never seen, read it, understand the argument, close it, reflect on it, and write a one paragraph response, you are one out of every 5 people on the planet.
Wow.
And yet 90% of our evangelism, discipleship, and leadership training tools are built for the small minority of the world that's like us. That's how we do training. And it doesn't work in these other kinds of cultures. So oftentimes we've left a Bible, or we've left a systematic theology book and said, "See you later, bye." And it's no wonder that there's so much syncretism around the world. So that, in fact, you look at Rwanda, it was over 90% baptized Christian when in the space of less than 100 days, about 1 million people are hacked to death by the machetes of their baptized Christian brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had the name Christian, they had the Bible, they had churches, but no one had ever taught them deep discipleship and how to apply Christianity to your life and who's a genuine believer and who's not, et cetera. So we have miles to go before we sleep. And what we find is, I believe the greatest need in the world is to go to the world that's not discipled and to bring them to that place. You think about yourself and your own life. How many times did you hear the gospel before you heard the gospel?
Right.
And in the world around, the great tragedy is not that it's unreached. The great tragedy is that it's not discipled. And we've got to go back to these places, learn their languages. And you know what? We've made it even harder because people think that they're believers now. It's a sort of a slash and burn evangelism approach where you have to go back and now you have to convince them that what they have is not biblical. It's not evangelical. It's not the true gospel, and you have to help them understand that just having your name on the roll at that building is not what it is to be in a right relationship with God through Christ, and that's the hardest work. But there, you know, the very interesting and the fun thing is that the leaders in all of these different areas around the world, they're the ones pleading for us to come and train every single day of the year. Every day, I get at least one invitation for us to bring reaching and teaching training to a place where we're not currently working. And of course, we can't say yes to everything, but the itch is there and they can't reach it to scratch it. And they're saying, "Come and train us, come help us." And it's overwhelming. It's encouraging. It gets me up in the morning, but it keeps me up at night too. I just wonder, how are we going to help these people to truly understand what the Bible teaches so that they can understand it, remember it, and apply it to the people who come after them knowing that night is coming when no man can work. And meanwhile, either church is stateside or arguing about what color to paint the handle on the lawnmower, or we've got missionaries who just want to make these newsletters that say we went into Somalia and we preached the gospel and three of us got martyred, but, you know, and hopefully not. But I mean, it's some, they want to go to the unreached as if that's what missions is. And that is part of missions. That's the first half. But once you reach them, you have to ask yourself the question, now what?
And it sounds like you're describing more than one approach to this idea of teaching and training. Like, there is a formal seminary aspect of it, which obviously you believe in. You've been a part of multiple seminaries overseas and, or I shouldn't say overseas, but in South America and here in the States, but also a different kind of training that would appeal to oral learners as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. In fact, if you think about it like a triangle, like a pyramid, the very top would be the highest academic level theological seminaries for the analytical, abstract thinker, theologian types. So you'd have, you know, like we have here in the States of Southern Seminary and Southwestern and Trinity and, you know, just these high level academic, almost theological university type places. And then there's a swath through the middle of that triangle where these people could probably understand the training if you come out to their communities and you say, okay, everybody read this chapter this week and we're going to talk about it when I come back next week. And it's sort of theological education by extension, where we take seminary to people. But the largest group of people who need to have deep discipleship and training is that bottom of the pyramid, of course. And we know that outside the U.S., 85% of the pastors have no theological education and no access to it. In fact, in the U.S., we have a trained Christian worker for every 235 people. Outside the U.S., that drops to one for every 450,000 people.
Wow.
Western-style seminaries don't meet the need because either people cannot or do not read, or they don't live anywhere near a seminary, or they couldn't afford to leave their farms and their families where they're subsistence farmers and go to the city. They don't have either the funds or the prerequisite degrees or the literacy abilities. And if they did go to the capital city or come to the U.S. and go to school where there is a seminary, even if they could jump through all the hoops and make that happen, after spending 3 or 4 years in a seminary, they're surely not going to go back out into the bush or into the jungle and live. Their kids were young when they left. Now they've lived in the big city for 3 or 4 years. Those kids don't know the language. They don't know the home culture. They don't know what it's going to be like to be without hospitals, policemen, shopping centers, grocery stores, and live out. And those people don't want to go back to dysfunctional societies where maybe now they're suspect because they left. And it's not that I blame them or don't blame them. I'm just saying that's reality. We know that 80% of the internationals who come to the U.S. to study, ostensibly to get an education, don't go back home. And that brain drain is exacerbated by the fact that it's the smarter ones who can jump through all the hoops and get the visas and raise the support necessary to come to the States. So it's not that we're just taking people out. We're taking the brightest and best out. And so what we've got to do is take training to them. So you're right. It needs to be in a way that is tailored to their situation, which is another reason why the Hearts, Heads, and Hands curriculum has fit so well so many different places, is because we don't require it. We don't require literacy. We don't even need the material translated into your language. As long as we have someone who's bilingual, that I can stand here in the front of this gathering of guys and I can say, hey, you know, I'm David Sills. I'm from the States. I'm here to teach you today about the New Testament and what you need to know about it. And that you can say that in that language. Now we can have a simultaneous translation all the way through with, so you're not requiring literacy. You're not requiring the material to be translated into their language. And they have to go out and immediately teach somebody else. It's one of the requirements we have. So I tell them this, my class doesn't cost you a penny. We don't charge anything for what we teach, but I tell them it's very expensive. And they look at me kind of suspiciously, and I say, what I mean by that is the requirement is you have to teach a group or a person or a gathering of folks in your home or something. What we teach you this week, before we come back next time, you will have had, and we start off asking them, now, how'd it go? What questions did you get that you couldn't answer? And let's start with that. And so, and that's because that's the only way to teach these people how to teach is to make them teach. It's like riding a bicycle or playing a guitar or flying in a plane or swimming. You can read books about it all day long, but to really become proficient, you have to do it. And so we make them teach, we make them preach, apply the information, and they really learn it. Then when we finish, it takes us 3 years to go through the program. But when we finish that training, we know that they're able to continue the ministry after we leave.
How then do you know? I mean, I think you've established the case that we pulled out of some areas before they were ready for us to be pulling out in out of mission work. But how do you, as a missiologist, as a mission leader, know when is it the right time then for missionaries to move from a certain region, a certain people group, and focus on other people groups that have yet to be engaged? How do you determine that?
Yeah, that was the big question. In fact, when I wrote the book, the Reaching and Teaching book, it was sort of highlighting those challenges, because some agencies who, you know, after AD 2000, when everybody thought, you know, Jesus was going to have a lot of respect for our Roman calendar and come back in AD 2000. And then when he didn't, they thought, whoops, okay, what do we do now? But at least in the beginning of that whole realization is, my soul, look at all these people groups out there that still haven't heard the gospel. And so so much missiological research was being done around the world to identify where are the hidden pockets of peoples, where are the people groups that do and do not have churches or Bibles or any kind of Christian ministry, the Jesus film, anything. And as we began to realize what those are, people began to want to go as quickly as possible to reach as many as possible, to check off as many squares as possible on the unreached list. But that resulted in us leaving too quickly. And so they began to use metrics like, well, if you're at least 2% evangelical, we will say you're at least reached. So we need to get on to those who've never heard at all. And people were moving so quickly that what they were leaving behind was caving in on itself. And it was purely syncretism and worse. So I was highlighting some of that. And there was one chapter dedicated to your question. How much is enough? When can we pull out? It's a long book. Well, it's not a long book, but it is a long chapter to answer the question, which I won't give you now. I'll just summarize it by saying, when they understand the redemptive narrative and the message of the Bible, they can remember it and they can teach to others everything that Christ commanded. Jesus said, go make disciples, teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded. And we have, you know, more New Testament instruction, the things you heard from me, entrust these things to others who can teach them to others also. And Paul says older women teach the younger women. So that principle of discipleship is there. When they have that, they will, number one, they're going to be better teachers than we are. They know the culture and the language and how to communicate best. They know the relationships and the testimonies. But to be apt to teach also includes that you know what to teach. And so it's time to leave. When they know what they need to know and they can pass that on to others and they can maintain a pure church. So what a lot of missiologists have done is when we're, because it is a big task, right? We're trying to reach the whole world for Christ's sake. And there's a lot to do. There's not that many of us, but you look at the world. And so you start driving around different countries and you pull into a village and you think, my soul, I wonder if they're reached yet here. And you see a church building, it's got a cross on top, it's got a sign that says they meet on Sundays at 10 o'clock. You kind of peer in the windows and you see some pews and it looks like the pulpit's been used. And so you think, well, okay, I guess they're operating, and you drive on to the next village. But if you were to get out and stay there for a week or so and scratch below the surface, what you might find is that they've just blended in the voodoo of the past, witchcraft, whatever world religion, even our world religions, they've just blended those in with Christianity so that the end result, now, I'm not just talking about precision evangelical theology where some people say, oh man, you're really, you're cutting the hair too fine. even take, say, John Paul II. Before he died, they took him on a tour of Latin America, since that's the largest part of the Catholic Church. And they asked him at the end of the tour, after he had seen all of these syncretized versions of Catholicism and just the mixture of even in Catholicism, even in Catholic churches where people are sacrificing chickens and just everything, they said, what do you think about your church? And in a very bewildered way, he said, Latin America needs to be re-evangelized. And if you were to Google that term, re-evangelization of Latin America, some of the sites that pop up are Vatican sites, mm-hmm. because he launched an effort to help them to understand what even Catholicism teaches.
So he was careful not to use the term reformed, I guess.
Exactly, right. And so you have Miguel Nunez from Dominican Republic, who is pushing also for re-evangelization of Latin America and bringing Reformation ideas to Latin America, because, you know, really those ideas didn't enforce, get even south of the Pyrenees from France down into Spain, so certainly didn't. In fact, the Reformation didn't start in 1517, so when the Spaniards came in 1492, they weren't bringing Reformation ideas. So in other words, what we have here is something that you and I would be very uncomfortable with, but as far as the Americas, but even John Paul II realized that. So back to the main point is that these folks, Paul Hebert, missiologist, anthropologist, was teaching at Trinity when he came to the end of his earthly years. He's with the Lord now. Great guy, one of my heroes. But he used to say, when you go into a new culture, you have to learn what they believe before you get started. Because he said the old religions don't go away. They go underground. And you have to always be sensitive to when they're popping back up and being blended in with what you're teaching week by week.
You know, you make a good point, because I think for those here that are listening that are more theologically astute, we don't grasp just what a real threat that syncretism is. Like whenever we have our long-term field prep trainings here, getting ready to send people over to places like West Africa, we talk about the fact that voodoo that we see here in parts of America, certainly, but you know, largely from Central America and the Caribbean, where it's practiced. But we see that was the syncretism of African tribal religion, traditional religion, which is, of course, polytheistic and demonic. But it's that with some of these Roman Catholic, you know, worship of saints and things like that. And basically the pantheon of African tribal spirits was merged with the Roman Catholic pantheon, as it were, of saints, the canon of saints, so that, you know, you might call them by different names now, but it's the same thing. You're contacting different spirits to help you with different things. And so go into some of these voodoo settings and you see pictures of Madonna and Jesus and all these sorts of things, but not realizing that what's represented behind that is these African traditional spirits and the occult behind that. But it looks almost Roman Catholic, mm-hmm. you know, by the illustrations, the paintings and different artifacts that are used. You know, I think it's important what you're saying here is that we really are talking about the very basics of the Christian faith, that there's one God, that there's one mediator between God and man, emphasizing those truths.
Well, a thought came to my mind as we were talking, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about it as well. But, you know, if I recognize there's an orphan problem around me, the solution isn't abandon my children to go take care of orphans. It's raising my children and influencing my circle to be effective in solving that problem going forward. And one of the things we've seen at ABWE, and I think, you know, I'd love to hear your comments on this as well, is that in some of the places we've served a long time, we've been in Peru something like 70 years. You know, Peru and a lot of, especially in the cities, would be generally considered reached by people. But one of the beauties of staying in a place for a while is that now we've seen in Brazil and Peru and Chile and other places where we've been for numbers of years, actually those churches, as they've been trained and matured, are now very passionate about taking the gospel to where other places outside. And the Peruvians are sending their own missionaries overseas to the Middle East and other places.
Places where us white Americans aren't easily trusted.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, does that say something about our culture? And I'd love you to speak into this, that we don't see missions, we see missions as just us, rather than seeing how a long-term concerted effort in some regions and finishing the task there could actually multiply missions efforts rather than subtract from them into the other unreached places. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that is precisely the situation. There are, the Holy Spirit is raising up people from other countries and other cultures to go as missionaries as well. The Great Commission wasn't given to United States citizens. It's given to His church. And so we need to be doing that. And it's clear that the Holy Spirit is calling up people, giving people a passion. They sense it themselves as they are growing in the Lord. They think, yeah, I want to do this too. I want to go to the nations. The challenge is, if you think, I mean, just sort of track this out. This is, I tell missionaries, this is not rocket science. Just think about it. All I did when I came to your village was I preached the gospel. I got a show of hands. I left you with that understanding, and I formed you into a little church and said, be warm and well fed. I'll see you in heaven one day. I've got to reach the rest of the unreached as quickly as possible. Yeah. So here I go. So I go, and you guys begin to continue whatever it is that I left behind. But you sense this passion to tell other people what little you do know. That's good. But what happens is, for instance, the Back to Jerusalem movement from China, they have a great passion to take the gospel all the way around the world back to Jerusalem. They want to continue the task. And yet they go out without any kind of cross-cultural training, without any theological training in many cases. And when they fall apart in a shame, honor culture, and they have to come back, it's a much bigger ramification. But just to give a quick, for instance, of that, one Chinese business guy was telling a friend of mine that he was going to go to Pakistan and be a missionary. And he said, really? And he said, how are you going to go? And this Chinese, very sincere brother, he said, I'm just going to go. And he said, you don't have a mission agency or anything like that? And he said, no, I'm just going to go. He said, well, how are you going to support yourself? And he said, well, I'm going to do what I do here. I'm going to sell noodles at a noodle stand. And he said, well, what kind of noodles you think you're going to sell to make enough money to survive and live there? And he said, pork noodles. Right. He said, yeah. Do you know they don't eat pork in Pakistan? He said, oh, they just haven't tasted it yet. So, right. I mean, clearly that's going to show up on CNN, I suspect, before it's over with, but well-meaning. And in two different cases, one from the Dominican Republic, one from Bolivia, just talking about the need for training, not just theological training and biblical background, biblical studies, but even cross-cultural, intercultural communication, world religions understanding, even that kind of training that we normally would have in a missions training school. That we also need to teach nationals this, because both from the DR and from Bolivia, two different stories, two different people, two different countries. But in both countries, I heard this story where, for instance, in Cochabamba, some Baptist brothers were telling me that they had sent their first missionary to Egypt. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. And they said, yeah, but we need to figure out how to train them better before they go. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, she had only been there for a few months, and she sent us a letter back saying that she was very thankful to us for believing in her and sending her and providing support, but not to send any more money. It wouldn't be right to take it because she had converted to Islam. And in both cases, both from the DR and the Bolivian situation, in both cases, those imams in the Muslim countries sent them back to their home countries again to be missionaries to their own people for Islam, because they knew the languages, the cultures, the relationships, and they were sent back that way. So we have to not just, in other words, it sounds really cool to go and preach the gospel, get a show of hands, and isn't this wonderful, and let's just move right on.
Right.
But we have to remember that's not what we've been commanded to do. And they will be better missionaries. They will be able to go places we can't go. And we talk about creative access all the time. I think our most creative access might be going to places we can go, training up those people that the Holy Spirit is calling up, raising up to send out, and training them so that they can go without that dark blue passport that causes us so much trouble in many countries. And they can go into places where we can't go. But they would be able to go with training and do solid Christian ministry, training people in ways they understand, can remember, and retell to others.
I heard our collective roar of approval from all of our South America missionaries saying yes.
They're cheering. Well, yeah. And I think it might have been you, Dr. Sills, who tweeted something over the weekend like, you know, we don't send people into combat untrained. I mean, look at the military, the right. United States military, and the insane amount of man hours that go into everything before deployment. And yet we somehow think that, you know, let me get to the field as fast as I possibly can in some of the hardest places that I possibly can get into. You know, we almost wear it as a badge of honor how many notches we can get on our belt of creative access countries that we've been able to get personnel into. And I'd love to hear you speak to the church, maybe the missions committee member or the person involved in missions, who their main metric that they're using to measure the effectiveness of someone is, are they working with the unreached? And this arbitrary number of 2%. You know, and so if someone's not working with an unreached people group, we're not going to support that. We're going to send people only to the 1040 window. You know, how would you counsel them to use some discernment in how they evaluate other ministries? And then I had two other questions to ask you before we wrap up.
Well, for that one, I would say, not to be disrespectful, but I would encourage them to read the Bible, because that's, you know, what we've been told to do is to disciple and to train. The one who knows trains the one who comes after, the one who doesn't know. Moses told parents to do that with children. Paul told older women to do it with younger women. He tells Timothy to do it with the faithful men around him so that they can train still others. Jesus commanded us in the Great Commission to go and make disciples and to teach them to obey all that he had commanded. So that's what we are to do. And if we measure it simply by getting the gospel to the unreached, you know, I think there are some people who and I've been setting it up as a straw man, and they might say, wait, sure. That's not me. That's an unfair caricature, because I think, and I think this is true, there are some people who think when I say go reach the unreached, or when they challenge conferences of young people and they say go out there and reach the unreached, what they think is happening is that people are going to the unreached, they're winning them to the Lord, they're discipling them, they're forming them into New Testament churches with biblically qualified leaders, and they're making sure that what continues is what we see in the New Testament. I think they think that's what is happening when people answer the call to go to the unreached.
Right.
But what happens is, if for you, missions equals reaching the unreached, this new error or lie that we've embraced in modern Christianity, if for you missions equals reaching the unreached, then when you go to a village where there is no church, no evangelical presence, people come to know the Lord, and you think, wonderful, this is great, you're beginning to disciple them, your role is changing from pioneer now to sort of a parent. And the parent has to raise the children and that sort of deal. You begin to have this sense of holy restlessness or this unease. And you're talking with your wife and you say, honey, I just don't know what the deal is. I just don't. And then it dawns on you one day, I know what it is. I'm not a missionary anymore. I'm supposed to be preaching the gospel to people who've never heard it. And here I am pastoring a church. This is crazy talk. I need to leave. And so they leave much too quickly, and what they leave behind are people who may have heard the true gospel, they may have responded to the true gospel, but they've not been discipled. No one ever has trained them. They don't know how to get the truth, but you're leaving because, after all, you're a quote-unquote missionary, and missionaries reach unreached people. So a lot of these conference speakers, I think, when they challenge young people to go reach the unreached, they really and truly think that people who answer that call are going to stay, but they're not. That because for you and for many mission agencies, missions is reaching the unreached. That's what we're supposed to do. And you might ask, well, then who is going to disciple them? Who's going to train them up? And that is another reason why I think reaching and teaching has found the embrace from so many mission agencies who want to partner with us, is because they say that's not what we do, but we see increasingly it needs to be done. Mm. So come work with us over here. We're going to, you know, they may be the Billy Graham. They're going to go in and preach the gospel. That's what God's called them to do, is be the Billy Graham around the world. Wonderful. Do it. Needs to happen. But somebody, either you need to change your P from being pioneer to be parent and eventually be partner, either you need to be willing to change your role throughout your career, or before you leave, you need to make sure somebody comes in behind you to continue that discipleship and nurturing.
Right, which is what Paul always sought to do, because he says in Romans 15 that he wants to go and not build on someone else's foundation. But he also appoints men like Timothy to stay behind him. We need Pauline really pioneers and people, Timothy's.
That's right. Folks want both sides of the equation. Those who say we want to be search people, trying to preach the gospel where Christ has never been named, and people who say, no, I'm more of a bring in the harvest kind of person. I'm more of a disciple or church planner or training up pastors kind of person. They both point to Paul as their hero, right? And because he did both, and they don't even realize they're talking past each other. So we should never ask ourselves, what should we do? What is our priority? Should we reach the unreached, or should we bring in the harvest? Because they're two sides of the same coin biblically. Once we ask the question, we're allowing ourselves a dichotomy that the Bible doesn't know. We must do both.
I think that's really helpful. I think there is a good impulse to say, hey, where is the gospel not gone? But we also need to make sure that when we do go to those places, we stay and go long enough to make sure that we're not creating false disciples.
So the two questions that I wanted to give you as we wind down a little bit is first, you're there in Louisville in the center of the bow tie brigade, the theological, you know, the Bible Belt, you know, but particularly, you know, you're there at the Mecca of big God theology type of people. And honestly, the question for us sort of would be, you know, we do this podcast to help bridge the world of theology with the world of missions. Where are the people that are going? Not just to reach, not just to evangelize, but to stay and train and teach and plant churches and to teach theology. Where are they? And then second, for maybe someone out there who's beginning to think about that, based on what you've written, how would you encourage them? And I know you said you're one of the least mystical people out there, too. And me and Scott would fall into that camp as well, probably, if we talked about that.
I'm a little mystical.
A little mystical. but how would you encourage them to discern a calling? And what would that mean for you? What would be a step they can take in that direction?
Okay, well, this, as we say, where I'm from, this may be a lot of sugar for a nickel, but I'll try to cover it all. I'll just say.
We don't say that up here in Pennsylvania.
No, but I like it.
You're too cold to say it up there. No, and with regard to where I am, you're right. This kind of context of the sort of the people that come here, the people that Southern tends to attract, you know, Dr. Moeller has sort of amassed a certain faculty, and that attracts a certain student body. And it makes it a very fun place to be if you care about training and theology, whether you're talking about theology proper or whether you're talking about, you know, biblical counseling or worship leadership or just everything, missions, evangelism, church planning. We'd cover it all. And if you're interested in academia and you have to be in the States, there's nowhere to go from here but heaven. I think this is just like the pinnacle, I really think. But because I have all these kinds of people who are the more theologically minded people, and they think, okay, well, I'm going to be the next John Piper. I know that's why I'm here getting my training, or I'm the next John MacArthur or whatever. I think, okay, maybe. But part of the plan here at Southern Seminary, if you walk through the door, you have to take introduction to missiology. You have to take introduction to evangelism. That's just one of our high values is evangelism and missions at Southern. So we're thought of as this, you know, sovereignty of God, theology proper type seminary. And we are that. I think we're the best at that personally. But we also care a great deal about the advance of the kingdom in pure and responsible ways around the world. And we want missions in people's face. We have a center for taking people around the world to see how they can be involved in missions. So there's reaching and teaching. We're not connected to the seminary, but I'm there and I make those opportunities available. Our Bevan Center for Student Mobilization is there. We have a center for help people. It's for the Christian understanding of Islam. So we're helping our students have a broader worldview because God can't lead you based on information you don't have. And right. So we want them to understand what's out there in the world. And I want to take them to another culture, get their passport stamped, because I think they'll be ruined for a normal life once you do. Either they're going to read their Bible differently, preach differently, watch the news differently, pray differently as a result of having gone, or God's going to get in their heart like he got in mine and push them outside of their comfort zone. So I think with Southern Seminary being here, the way that I challenge people to add, just figure out your place in God's plan for the world. You know, God, I believe, is a sovereign God. I think he's got it all worked out already. And he's not wringing his hands wondering, oh, my soul, what's going to happen in the news tomorrow? But at the same time, we have a role to play. So I believe strongly also in the responsibility of man. And my responsibility is to understand that God has a plan for the world. What is my role in that plan? So what I tell people, the first English book I wrote was called The Missionary Call. And in that book, I think it's the second chapter, I just tell you, look, if you're trying to discern God's call on your life with regard to missions, or really with regard to anything, but especially missions, and I'll just do the snapshot version of that, there are eight ingredients that need to go in that cake. If the cake is God's will for my life.
Now you have my attention. We're talking about baked goods.
There we go. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think I just brought a whole bunch of listeners right back into focus here. So, seriously, for me, that's how I think of it. It's not eight easy steps, but it's at least ingredients that need to be cooked into this cake. You know, I need to think about these. I put them all on the table, these eight components, eight ingredients. And they are, number one, the only way we can really know God's will is to know God. That's the first step. We can't just be so concerned about the result, the product, that we're not concerned about the source. So you have to know him. And you think, well, if we didn't have the Bible, what would we know about him? I mean, we would know that he is. We'd know from creation that there is a creator, but that's about all we'd know. So he revealed himself. He gave us his word. But to really know him, you have to spend time in his word and know his word. But, you know, we have to do like David. We have to say, open my eyes that I might see wonderful things in your law. So we need to spend time in prayer and ask God to shape our understanding, illumine our minds. The same God who inspired the word can illumine our minds to understand it. So know him, know his word, spend time in prayer. Fourth, seek counsel from the graybeards around you, those who have lived godly lives, who know you well, to give you counsel. Don't let them tell you God's will for your life, but seek counsel from them. And then fifth, look at your, what Henry Blackaby used to call your spiritual markers or your life experiences, the building blocks of your life, who God has made you to be. Consider those things. And then consider your circumstances. Your circumstances might be open doors, closed doors, opportunities that are available to you, natural giftings. Don't just use a litmus test of throwing out a fleece, or, you know, if the phone rings three times and they hang up, I don't know, I'm supposed to ask Jill to marry me or something like that. You know, don't do that to you, to God, or to Jill. But what you do need to think about circumstances, though. If you're trying to decide whether to marry Sally or Jane, but you're already married to Jill, then neither Sally nor Jane is God's will. So circumstances do matter. But remember, you know, even Jesus calls the devil the god of this age, and the Bible calls him the prince, the powers of the air. He can manipulate circumstances as well. So, but you can at least consider them. They're one of the ingredients. So know God, know his word, spend time in prayer, seek counsel, look at your life experiences, consider your circumstances, and then look at the timing. All the lights may be green, but is this really the right time? Ecclesiastes 3 says there's a time for everything, so that's legit to keep on the table. And then finally, if you're trying to discern God's call, what do you want to do? And that doesn't sound very spiritual, but Psalm 37:4 says to delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. And I think that means he gives you the desire, and then I think it also means he gives you the desire. So that if I'm saying, Lord, all I want is all you want, I just be glorified through my life, Lord, not my will, but yours be done. He begins to put the seed of a desire in your heart that maybe you'd never noticed before, or maybe it was never there before, to do a certain thing. Not if I'm delight myself in the world of the flesh, but if I'm delight myself in the Lord, he will give me that sense of, man, I love languages. I love travel. I love other cultures, other food. I want to share the gospel with somebody who's never heard it. I want to help somebody to understand God's word and just make my life count in that way. You begin to have a desire for that you never even noticed before. And then as you begin to follow that, He is pleased. He receives pleasure. And we are contented because we are doing what he wants. And he blesses us with his pleasure. And then he gives us the desire. In other words, he brings it to fruition. Mm-hmm. So no one of those things, I would say, this is how you know God's will for your life. And I would not say, go, you know, open up a blank Word document or a legal pad and say, God, I'm just going to fast and pray until you tell me your will for your life, because we'll find a skeleton sitting in front of a legal pad, because God doesn't work that way. But if you were to just put all those things on the table and say, Lord, there's a big world out there. What's my place in it? Do you want me to stay here? Because I think, in fact, Moody Publishers took out of that book, The Missionary Call, and put on the cover one of the quotes from it that said, what I believe personally, the highest and best use of anyone's life is to do what God has called them to do in the place where he calls them to do it. So I think if God has called you to be a housewife in Oklahoma City, I do not think you can glorify him more by being martyred in Somalia.
That's a great word.
I think you glorify him most by doing what he's—
there's a lot of moms that are rejoicing that you said that too.
Well, I'm glad. They should. They need to be the best mom they can to the glory of God.
Amen.
That's what he's made them to be and do. And so we don't put false guilt of twisting people's arms to go to the mission field. If we do, we got to go with them and keep twisting it to keep them there. You know, that's not what it's about. It's helping people to discern, what does God want me to do? Now, I mean, and I'll say this, I know we're getting ready to wrap it up, but there's one other aspect of that I want to say, because some people too easily excuse themselves by saying, well, no, I don't have a desire to go, so clearly that's not for me. You know, when you think about the fact that, you know, around the world, a third of the people living today have never heard the gospel, and every day out of that number, about 50,000 people on average daily die and go into a Christless eternity from places where there is no gospel witness. And, you know, you think God's okay with that? You think, well, maybe he's just not calling people anymore. I think that he is. But I'm also staggered by the fact that about 80% of evangelical pastors serve within 200 miles of their wife's mama. You know, and I wonder who's calling whom when you look at those kinds of numbers.
Oh.
So in 1896, this guy in Atlanta invented this stuff we're supposed to drink called Coca-Cola, and it cost him $70 to make it. He only sold $50 worth, and it was a $20 loss, clearly, and back in that day, that was a big hit. But he stayed with it, and he began to do a little better, and now in 2018, the Coca-Cola logo and the product itself is recognized by over 95% of the people on planet Earth. And I have been in villages in the past few months. I have been in villages where there is no church, no Jesus film, no gospel witness whatsoever, no tall steeple, certainly, no missionary, and yet the little store sells Coca-Cola. And if we can do it in 121 years, whatever it is, 122 years for profit, why in 2,000 years can't we do it for the glory of God and obedience to Christ's command? So part of the problem is we've tried to finish the task by coming up with this managerial missiology of just, okay, let's just do 2%. Let's move on to the next group, move on to the next group. When in fact, Jesus said he will build his church, right? So let's take that pressure off of us. He's going to do that. I'm not to finish the Great Commission. I'm to be faithful to it. And to be faithful to it means I take the gospel, I preach it, I help people come to understand what it is to be a believer. Then I'm discipling them, and then I'm training up people who are New Testament qualified leaders of Christ Church so that they can continue the work. Then God will give me a peace about when it's time to move on.
I appreciate that. That's a great word. And I would just say that if you're listening and you're wrestling with God's calling, a couple steps. One, make sure you talk to your pastor. Like, that is someone who knows you well. Sit down with them and share them what God might be doing in your heart. And then I also want to say, we're here to talk to you as well. So that's what Alex and I love to do. We have a team here. I know John Dietrich with Reaching and Teaching, I'm sure, would love to talk to them as well. You can tell John that we gave him a plug here on the podcast.
I'll do it.
but I know John in the office would love to, Reaching and Teaching, would love to talk to them as well. And probably Dr. Sills, they can come register for your class and get a little bit of that at Southern as well. But
I'd love to have that.
We're so thankful for our listeners, and really thank you for that great, great sound biblical advice to those who may be wrestling with God's call.
Yeah. Dr. Sills, how can they get a hold of you and more of what you've written if they want to learn more about this?
Yeah. Well, one way it would just be to go to reachingandteaching.org. And on there is a tab that goes to books, and you can look on there. They're mostly linked to Amazon or to Lifeway or to Moody, but you could go either to the publisher or you can go to Amazon and order them. They're on Kindle as well. But through Facebook, through Twitter, you can find me those ways, or just contact me through the Reaching and Teaching website. I would love to answer any questions. If anybody's church is trying to figure out how to do missions or what is it like to actually take Hearts, Heads, and Hands and train someone else, even in the States, many pastors are beginning to use it now that they're finding out about it, just for training up leaders in their own churches here, because they realize that it's just basic curriculum that everyone needs to know about discipleship and head knowledge and skill set. So they can reach me through the website of reachingandteaching.org, or through Facebook, Twitter, anything they want to use. I am among you as one who serves, and I would be glad to help any way I can.
Feel free to check out their blog too. Under reachingandteaching.org, you have a blog, but also a podcast over 50 different podcasts that people can jump into and get more of this great content.
That's fantastic. Dr. Sills, thank you again so much for joining us today. We'd love to have you back sometime, and there's a lot we can dig into.
Oh, I'd love to do it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Missions Podcast. If you want to get more great content on theology, missions, and practice, go to missionspodcast.com. And while you're there, make sure that you subscribe in iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite listening platform. And please make sure that you also give us an honest review and a 5-star rating. And please don't forget to be sending your questions to alex@missionspodcast.com, along with any other ideas for future episodes. And until next time, thank you for joining us.